Good afternoon. I'm opening the next session, and I'm Susan Gaskin, Professor of Civil Engineering at McGill. And it's going to be my pleasure this afternoon to introduce Julie Payette, who's Canada's woman astronaut. And she was chief astronaut at Canadian Space Agency from 2000 to 2007. A little bit of background. At McGill, we're very proud to say she's a graduate from electrical engineering, graduating cum laude in 1986. She also has a master's from University of Toronto. And this trained her so that she could become a systems engineer and a robotics expert. In 1992, from among over 5,000 applicants, she was chosen to be one of four astronauts chosen by the Canadian Space Agency. She then underwent training, which included going to NASA and getting her military flight license. She then became an expert in systems engineering, robotics, and communications in the astronaut corps. She's had two space flights, the International Space Station, 10 days in 1999 on the shuttle Discovery, where she was responsible for station systems and the Canadarm. And in 2009, on the space shuttle Endeavour, where she was responsible for robotics altogether, three arms now, for an important assembly mission. And on top of all this, she's a very accomplished musician, has sung with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra. She's the mother of two kids. I think she's highly recognized. She's got the Knight of the Order of Canada, the Knight of the National Order of Quebec, plus an Officer of the Order of Canada. Over 18 honorary doctorates from Canadian universities. I think she's an inspiration to us all. When I heard about this talk, I asked my kids, "Do you know Julie Payette?" My daughter said, "Oh yes, she's in my history book last year." And my son said, "Is she going to wear her spacesuit?" Anyway, I think we're all just as excited to hear what you have to say today. Julie Payette.
Thank you. Bonjour. It's always a pleasure to be back at McGill University. It has changed. There's less cars on the campus and on McTavish. You know, I thought, hey, I've got it. I'm going to go and park on McTavish, which is the street right next to here. And then I realized that I was outdated. Alors aujourd'hui, évidemment, je vais faire ma présentation en anglais, mais je vous invite à la toute fin de m'adresser dans la langue de votre choix, bien entendu, comme toujours. This is a symposium about women in science, engineering, and medicine. Therefore, I am not here to talk about my experience in space as much as I am to talk about how you can use space or space travel by humans as an example of perhaps where we are today in the situation of women in science and engineering, not in medicine, because they're way further ahead than the other two. And so if you allow me, I will use the example of human space exploration as my backdrop for what I'd like to talk to you about. But before that, you see this picture? Is that a girl or a boy? Can you tell? Right there at the top of the Canadarm 2, which is the Canadarm which is on the International Space Station right now. You can't tell if it's a boy or a girl, but I can tell you that if you take a bet, if you go one way or the other, and you'd like to bet money on this, then I would definitely, definitely bet a boy. Considering that there are fewer than 10 women that have ever done a spacewalk. And one of the reasons for that is that the suit is made in three sizes. Medium, large, and extra large. So if you happen to not fit in one of those, then it's a little hard to perform well during the training so that you will be picked to do one of those jobs. Interestingly, the Bank of Canada is about to unveil the $5, a new $5 in polymer and very difficult to counterfeit and everything. On the back of it, there's an astronaut. So the governor of the Bank of Canada sees me at one function. He says, "Julie, I've put you on the back of the $5. And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Yes, we have an astronaut on the us." That's really great. And then I see that they've put one of those, which means that I don't fit in that suit. So I said, "Well, maybe I'm not on this." And I said, you should change it. You should change it with where we see the face of the astronaut. But anyway, I lost that battle. This said is that if you are a girl, it could be that you are in a lonely world in aerospace, and particularly in space exploration. In fact, if you are from Quebec or from Canada, it's all somewhat of a lonely world. If you speak French, definitely, it's a very lonely world. If you have long curly hair, forget it, you're by yourself. But we've had women astronauts. 528 people have flown in space since Yuri Gagarin in 1961, 50 years ago. 528. Of these, 56 women. If you do the math, it's a little less than 10%, it's 9.4% women. However, even though the first woman was Valentina Tereshkova, she flew in the second ever flight of a human being in space, right after Yuri Gagarin. She flew in Vostok 2 in 1963. I was not even born. I was born just a few months later. Well, Valentina Tereshkova, who was a very, very interesting person because she was an expert in parachuting, and she was also a very involved in the Youth Communist Party, and therefore represented the then Soviet Union very well. And they were adamant they were going to fly the first woman. It was just the very beginning of a space flight. They had flown the first living organism, a dog called Laika, on Sputnik 2. Then a man, Yuri Gagarin, in 1961, and then a woman. And then once they flew the woman, it took them 25 years to fly another one. And I'll tell you in what circumstances, is when they heard that at NASA, they were going to have the first woman doing a spacewalk. Whoops, they scrambled their manifest and put an astronaut, because they always have a woman astronaut in training. She just happens to never make it to the space seat, interestingly. Three Russian women have flown in space in the history of the Russian program. 113 Russian men have flown in space. If you do the math, that's 0.024%. A little less than 0.03%. Even though they are a powerhouse of human space exploration. So if you're a Russian woman, you're definitely on your own. Then the Americans came in. They are the ones that make all the difference. Because out of the 58 women, Are you keeping up with all the numbers there? Out of the 56 women that have flown in space from the very beginning up until now, 46 are American. Less than 10% of women come from somewhere else. Everybody else is American. And here's the first one. She unfortunately passed away just a few months ago, Sally Ride. She flew in 1983, just 2 years after the first flight of the space shuttle. Our first Canadian woman flew in the space shuttle in 1992. Then the first Japanese, Chiaki Mukai. Both Roberta Bandar in 1992, our Canadian, and Chiaki Mukai were called payload specialists. They were researchers that were brought into the space shuttle, which was manned by mission specialists, professional astronauts from the U.S., and they were going to take care of a whole slew of scientific experiments. This was the only way, really, to get non-U.S. women on board spaceship at the time. So that's how the first few ended up flying. And then the first European in 1996. That's not that long ago. A French woman, Claudie André-Désé. Was her name at the time, Claudie Engeret today, and she flew twice with the Russians. And then just a couple of months ago, on the 12th of June, actually 16th of June 2012, then China, which is the third nation able to send human in space with their own rockets, has sent the first woman, Liu Yang. And here she is. What's interesting about all this is that you can now apply to an astronaut program, even though you can't go to university just yet, and then sign up onto a course that says astronaut or spaceship operator or orbital flight attendant. It's coming.
but we don't have it yet. You can apply to an astronaut program if you're from one of the countries that have astronauts. So the USA, Canada, Japan, Russia, China, and Europe. So if you're from one of the European countries that contributes to the European Space Agency, you can apply to a space program and to an astronaut program. Most of the time, you have to have a technical degree. That's all they ask. You need to be a citizen of the country where you're applying. You need to have a scientific degree, so you need to be an engineer, a doctor, or a scientist. You need to have a good ability to communicate, and you need to be in good health. And they check that, I tell you. So it's not that hard, right? Those four criteria, many of us feel that very well. But when you apply, you go through a very, very, very wide selection, and you end up onto an astronaut program. And yes, indeed, everybody has a technical degree, but most people come from a very, very similar background. And I'll demonstrate that in a moment. So someone like me to come in there came a little bit from the side. And even at the very start of the training, I realized two things. One, this world was not designed, was not conceived, was not operating right now for people my size and people a little bit like me. So it was getting there, but it was not quite there. For example, this picture was taken in 1994 in a Tudor jet. That's one of those snowbird jets that our aerobatic team flies here in Canada. Well, it doesn't show on this picture, but my flight suit. Because I'm a girl of 5'6", I tend to have longer legs and a smaller trunk. That's how females are made. Most guys of 5'6" have a longer trunk and shorter legs because that's a shorter height. No, it's not all, but statistically it's about the middle. So when I was giving my flight suit, that's where the crutch was. So we'd have to have it tailored. Well, same with the parachute. For the longest time, without knowing, because I didn't know better, I had a parachute which was too big for me, and at one point in time, some of the technician figured it out and said, hey, if you have to eject, you're probably ejected the parachute as well. I said, that's not a good idea, let's fix that. Because, again, the length of the trunk was different. And that's the kind of things where you could see that that world was starting to try to get there, but the numbers were just not there enough. You know, why would they? They had so very few women pilots in the Canadian Air Force that they were just not quite there. They're there today. Anyway, continue the training. It was a lot of fun, but it was also very interesting because it's not that, we weren't qualified, all of us. We went through a rigorous recruitment program. It's just that there are so very few space seats, and they're so coveted, and everybody wants them, and there's such a high competition. There's nobody that's going to stop and say, hey, she hasn't had her chance, or he hasn't had his chance, so I'll let him go in front of me. There's no such thing happening in that world. It's highly competitive, and it turns out, unfortunately, still today, and I think that my colleague Suzanne Fortier will address you at the end, we'll mention that in particular, women are underestimated all the time. If they're here in capacity, if they're here in their abilities, they will be often judged right there. It's extremely rare, and maybe some people have that kind of experience, I don't, where you're judged here, above your capacity. That really, in science and technology, does not happen. On the contrary, you spend most of your time working to convince that you actually are where you are, to convince people around that you deserve to be there and you deserve one of the seats, and that you will do a good job and represent your country properly. So for several years, I worked hard. I was not the only one working hard. Again, this is a competitive place, and we all fought for those seats, and I got a seat on a crew that was very diverse, so diverse that it was only the second time in the history of the space shuttle that we had three women on board. Only one other flight had 3 out of 7, because that's a huge number. And one of them, Ellen Ochoa, which is on the if you are looking at the picture on the left-hand side, who is now the number two director at the Johnson Space Center, the training center in at NASA, Houston, Texas. She brought this flag. This is an original suffragette flag from 100 years ago when there was another fight being fought at the time by women, just for the right to have a voice on the political level. I thought that was very fitting, 1996. The next time, 10 years later, when I got assigned to a space mission, I was assigned to a different space mission with six other colleagues. And there, look at my colleagues. Yeah, they're nice, healthy men. They're all U.S., all American. So I'm in the middle, if you hadn't noticed, with my Canadian flag. So coming from the left, we have the only other civilian. He's a medical doctor, but next to him is a Navy SEAL. Next to him is a colonel from the Army. Then there's me. Then there's a U.S. Marine, a colonel as well. Then there is a colonel from the Air Force. And then there is a Navy flight surgeon. And this was my team. I trained with them for a year and a half, and it was an extraordinary mission. We had a heavy-duty construction mission of the International Space Station. And once we docked to the International Space Station, there were already six people on board, because that was just a couple of years ago. And of the six people on board, we had people from all the nationalities that are represented in the partners of the International Space Station. So someone from Japan, someone from Belgium, so from the European Space Agency, two Russians, one American, and then the whole seven of us that were coming in. Well, it just happened, all of them, to be guys. Interestingly, and that's one of my favorite anecdotes, when you go onto a space mission, short duration, like a space shuttle, where you need to do something very specific, like constructing the space station, every single minute of your day is scheduled onto a flight plan. And there are planners on the ground that decide that, and you are given your duty. Like, I was a robotic operator, I was a flight engineer, other people were spacewalkers, other people were this and that. And you do what you need to do, and it's right on the flight plan. Those who are very busy don't get scheduled for the maintenance duty, the cleaning stuff, right? Because they're busy doing robotics or everything. So of all the 16 days that I was in space with 12 other guys, I was never scheduled for vacuum cleaning duty. Considering the percentages that I was representing, it's just not bad. But now what I would like to tell you, it's not all about gender. It actually is not. When you want to prove yourself into a group that you are entering, and that your objective, your goal, your ambition is to do what that group does, is to be like they are, then you come in with your different characteristics, perhaps. And being a girl versus a boy might just be one characteristic and might not even be the one that plays the most. Let's look at this more closely. You guys know about the normal distribution, right? Here it is. I took that from the internet. So it's a nice curve, the bell curve. And every single time you have one of those vertical lines, we call them in a statistical term a standard deviation, or by this Greek letter, sigma, which it's this funny letter. So this is a completely non-scientific theory that I do not think you should reproduce in any way without running some risk of people laughing a little bit. But this is my theory of the sigma remove. So now, from that bell curve, we all agree that the very middle is the norm, right? In a given population, most people are in the middle, some people are at the top, some people at the bottom. It's the way the normal distribution works. And it applies statistically to all kinds of things in science. So there's the norm. Now let's look at the astronorm. What is the norm of an astronaut? Considering that out of the 528 people that have flown in space, 70% are American, 30% from other nationalities. And out of the 528 people that have flown in space, all of them but 56 are men. You can start drawing some somewhat statistics. So if you are trying to do the portrait of what is a normal astronaut, then you come up with things like that. That person is of white skin, male, American, come from the military, remember my crew? Yeah, Navy, Marine, Air Force, Army, they're great. They're absolutely perfectly groomed to do this job at an extraordinary level. But they all come, many of them, from the military. Most astronauts have pilot license. Most of them are engineers, 75% of them. Most astronauts, considering they're American, also are from English mother tongue. They're married, they have children, they're Christian. They have an average size, not too big and not too small. There's a few more things I could say, but they would be politically incorrect. So let's stick with those 11, let's call them sigma. Yeah, they're not real sigma because they're not exactly standard deviation and they don't add up mathematically. So again, do not use this literally. Now, let's look at a crew. In the green circles are the norm, the folks that fit exactly the 11 sigma that I've just described. We have two more folks that fit almost the 11 sigma. One of them was born in the UK, naturalized as an American, so he's not quite US, but and he happens to be a physicist. The other one is from Germany, speaks German and spoke German when he was 2 years old, so he's not quite. But he's one or two sigma removed from the norm. And therefore, that's not far. That's like being the same, right? And that's good. Now, let's look at being three sigma removed, because one or two, it's in the noise. It's like if you are indeed part of the norm, fit very well. At starting at three sigma, things start to become a little differentiable. So we have in person here who's not male, not a pilot, not of average size. She is therefore three sigma removed from the norm. Right? You understand the concept? So let's continue because we got one more person on this crew. There's the norm. Oh, before that, let me explain how if you are three sigma removed from the norm, the people in the norm, when they get in to the astronaut office the first day, they don't need to prove to anybody that they deserve to be there, right? They're like everybody. They're from the same background. They are a known quantity. And therefore, they go in there and they say, ready to work. Where do I go? And they get assigned things. And all they do then is put basically 100% of their energy climbing up the ladder that leads to the very coveted space seat that everybody wants. That's all they do, because they're in the norm. They don't need to convince anybody that they deserve to be there. One or two sigma removed? Yeah. Our German test pilot fits right in. He might have a twinge of an accent, but besides that, people know he can fly F-18s and he can do all these things. So he is like us, and therefore we can right away assign him less work. If you're three sigma removed, then you need to work your way toward the middle, where things start becoming interesting for you in terms of responsibility, in terms of getting near to the spacey. So the way you do that is you work hard, you demonstrate competence, which is the key, by the way, to all of this. You end up showing that, yes, indeed, you are worthy like the others, even though you don't have exactly the same background, or even though you don't have exactly the same characteristic, that you're worthy, and people, being great, will indeed embrace that very well, and then you make your way through time, perseverance, effort, and faith, really, in yourself, toward the norm, and your progression, instead of being straight up, if you were part of the norm, it's not that bad, it's just a little skewed, but you'll get there, and you will. Indeed, within the ambition, the objective, and the goal that you have, reach that goal. It is possible, anything is possible. So let's go back to my picture, and let's look at my friend, Stephanie Wilson. She joined the astronaut corps at NASA in 1996, the same year as me. Well, Stephanie's not white. She's not a guy. She's not military. She's not a pilot. She doesn't have an engineering degree. Stephanie is not married. She doesn't have children. She's not an average size. She doesn't fit much very well in the suit either. She is 8 sigma removed from the norm. It doesn't matter if you're an astronaut or if you're a ballerina. If you're coming into a particular place and you have this many characteristics away from the norm, be prepared to work hard to convince people that you deserve to be there. And she did. She has since flown twice in space and probably will be assigned to a third one. But she was one of the last people assigned in the class because of the fact it's not only about gender. It's an interesting way of looking at this. Fortunately, Stephanie had one characteristic, which was a much bigger, much weightier, much more important sigma than the others. She had the good fortune of being American. Because they are the ones, by far, in this particular world, that have pushed completely the frontier. The lady we see in the middle here is Peggy Whitson. She's from Iowa. She is a biologist, microbiologist. She was, for the last 5 years, the chief of the NASA astronaut office, the one that decides who goes where on which seat. She has the most days in space of all women in the world, 377 days, and just been assigned to be an astronaut for a one-year mission in 2015. Because in America, they have all the women and they make them do everything. They let them have responsibility, decision-making capability, and they put them into the exact same possibilities if you work hard and if you demonstrate. They're the only nation that does that, which tells me that we still have a long way to go. A long way to go, but at the same time, space is a great place to experience that because it is the only place where we have a laboratory like this one, the International Space Station, the size of 2 football fields, 8 habitable modules. It's been in space with people inside nonstop for the last 11 years. It's the only place in the world where people from different nations have put effort, money, resources, heart, and put people in harm's way for the sole purpose of advancing knowledge, of conducting scientific experiment in basic science, and doing it in collaboration, in cooperation, all together. That doesn't exist. This will go down in history as the first time we've ever done that. I hope we do it more and more, because there's a lesson to be drawn here. There is no murder up there. There's no conflict. There's no, well, if there is corruption, it's on the ground, then we deal with this. But decisions are there. People do not worry about who you are, what language you spoke when you were little, or what color you happen to be. Because once you're up there, we all work together. We all rely on each other, and we all share everything, because there's not a pair of scissors for everybody. So we have to share. And this is a beauty. That also. So in a world that in a way was so tight and still is for most nations, it's also a world of expansion and of hope and of moving forward, progress. And that world gave me my opportunity. If it hadn't been for the fact that I trained at NASA with the American Corps, I couldn't have sat in that seat, the flight engineer seat of the space shuttle, where you sit right in a front cockpit and you are a part of the crew that operates and fly the mighty space shuttle. This is the kind of thing that makes you think that maybe we still have some progress to do in Canada. I could expand on this, but if you go and look at the membership of the executive committee of the Canadian Space Agency, you will see that it's a single gender only. In 2012, that's unacceptable in a field that is open to everybody's opportunity. So really, this is not only about gender, but it is about having opportunities for everybody. Every single time we have a group underrepresented, and here I definitely include people with physical handicaps. In space, if you're a paraplegic, it doesn't make any difference. You're exactly as efficient as somebody else. But whenever you have groups that are underrepresented, particularly in science and technology, which is currently in a developed society like us, like ours, the backbone of our future as a knowledge-based society, then we lose. We need to have every single potential contributor, and we see a few here in this room, so that we progress as a society and that we're not completely tributary to other people's advances, but we contribute to it. We must seek, we must embrace, and we must celebrate diversity, always. We must also help it out, especially, and there are some women in this room that have achieved incredible amount of success, that have definitely climbed that ladder to their world. But once you get there, it is our duty to help out, to seek out, actually, the 7 and 8 sigmas out there, and to give them that opportunity if others don't. It is our duty, to some extent, but all of us as a citizen, to also say to our government, yes, we should have, if we can't have parity on the board of director of our public societies, then we should strive to have it. Because that would number, and we will then grow a more diverse world, and this let me prove to you that I deserve to be here will not be as necessary. And we are one of the most open, tolerant, and easygoing society in the world. There's no reason why we can't push that even further. And last but not least, go out there. Because this was a speech really for women in science, engineering, and mathematics, and medicine. Go out there, be all you can be. And don't forget that it could be that you can do this weird job for which nobody sees in you physically, but you have in your heart, and still be whoever else you want to be. Thank you so much. Do we have questions? No questions? At all? Yes, ma'am, thank you.
Do you have any future projects that you can share with us that you're
hoping to work on? Do I have future projects? I sure do. Right now, I am the scientific delegate of the Quebec government to the United States, which is a very long title to say that I'm a science attaché, and I foster more relationships and try to get people to talk, basically a science diplomat. Considering that I've lived the last, almost the last 20 years in the United States, so I have a lot of contacts, a lot of people I know, so I'm trying to make sure that somebody uses those contacts before I move on to something else. I'm also a representative for ArcticNet, which is a consortium, one of our Canadian Center of Excellence on Arctic and polar research, but not research only in science, but in social science, medicine, social health, and communities, governance, sovereignty, and all the rest. Because what is happening in the north of Canada right now is going to influence us all in the lower latitude, and now we need to be out there collecting data and out there understanding and analyzing what's going on. So we are better prepared for the warming up, which is going on right now. Thank you. Other questions? Young people have no questions? No, madam.
What motivated you to go to space?
I'm a very typical astronaut of my age era. I'm almost 50, not quite, but getting there. So astronauts of my generation, of almost every one of us, have been influenced by the Apollo mission. that took place between 1969 and 72 when people went to the moon. So I do remember sitting in the gym in a school north of Montreal and watching them, thinking, wow, they would put those big suits and they would climb into the rocket and then they'd shoot to the moon and then they'd drive that Jeep Rover there. And I thought, hey, me, that's me. I want to do that. And at the time, it didn't cross my mind because I was, what, 9, 8, 9, 10, about. It didn't cross my mind that, wow, I was the wrong nationality. I was definitely the wrong gender. I had the wrong language because I didn't understand a word they said. They spoke English. I didn't speak English. I also had never been anywhere near an airplane, let alone anybody in my family. And they were all military test pilots. But it didn't matter, because that is the power of great project. That's why we do this. We can't just do little projects at home. We need also to be out there reaching out to international projects in science, discovery, in pushing back the knowledge, and finding another Higgs boson. It's the kind of thing that really inspires young people to go and do something out there. So I was just like, wow, I want to be an astronaut. Everybody laughed. Except my parents had the good sense of always encouraging me to be what I wanted to be. Not, so they said, well, you want to be an astronaut? Sure. Then you better work hard. You better go to school. And, you know, you better get yourself organized. And we'll support you. They didn't think I'd make it, neither did I. But this is an amazing force to have your family behind you, no matter what you choose. I often say, and I think I said it to the child of someone here in the room, gentleman there, that I have a 9-year-old. You saw him on the picture. And I always say to him, you can be whatever you want to be. The only thing I would be disappointed is if you do nothing. If you sit on the sofa and do nothing, that doesn't run. But anything else goes. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
C'était un peu ma question, mais je me disais, et dans votre cheminement, qu'est-ce qui a changé dans l'éducation d'un enfant quand on est cheminé comme
le... Qui a changé dans mon éducation, dans l'éducation de mon fils? La question pour tout le monde, c'est si on a j'ai changé ma façon d'éduquer mes enfants. En fait, j'ai repris cet aspect-là. J'y crois fondamentalement. Je crois qu'on a tous du talent, c'est clair, et qu'on a tous un endroit où on peut contribuer, mais en fait, plusieurs endroits où on peut contribuer. On a tous un rôle et des rôles à jouer, et donc, il est en fait irresponsable de ne rien faire. On a quelque chose à contribuer, à apporter dans toutes les sphères de la société. Et c'est à nous, comme parents, d'essayer d'être un peu un guide pour présenter la panoplie de possibilités pour les enfants, mais il faut les laisser choisir et ensuite les encourager, même quand ils nous disent quelque chose qui est peut-être hors des sentiers battus. Or, il y a des professeurs ici qui doivent le savoir. Il y a des enfants qui vont dire, moi, je veux faire ci, puis il y a combien de fois, et on le sait, qu'en sciences et en ingénierie en particulier, la raison pour laquelle, une des raisons, parce que c'est multifactoriel, pour laquelle les femmes ne viennent pas en ingénierie en aussi grand nombre que les garçons et qu'elles ne restent pas aussi longtemps, qu'elles ne font pas des études aussi poussées en général, c'est beaucoup par la réaction qu'elles ont à l'extérieur, le soutien qu'elles ont à l'extérieur. Il y a toujours quelqu'un quand une jeune fille va rentrer du cégep puis dire « Moi, je aimerais devenir mathématicienne. » Il y a peut-être quelqu'un dans la famille, ça peut être une femme ou un homme. Malheureusement, ça peut être une femme aussi qui va dire « Ben voyons, mathématicienne, qu'est-ce que tu veux faire avec ce livre? C'est plat. » C'est pas vrai. C'est d'ailleurs un des sujets qui m'intéresse aussi. C'est comment pouvons-nous ôter la perception que les sciences et la technologie sont des endroits difficiles. C'est faux. C'est beaucoup plus difficile de devenir premier violon de l'Orchestre symphonique de Montréal. Moi, je ne pourrais jamais faire ça. Avec tout l'effort que je mettrais, je ne serais jamais capable. Mais je peux devenir astronaute, par contre. Parce que la physique
la chimie, les mathématiques, l'ingénierie, ça s'apprend. Et si on aime ça, ça s'apprend encore plus vite.
C'est donc un mythe que les sciences, la technologie soient difficiles. C'est un mythe qu'on ne peut pas être soi-même en sciences et qu'il faut avoir un certain modèle. C'est un mythe et c'est une perception qu'on doit essayer d'estomper, en peut-être avec des campagnes publiques. Hein. Aussi, j'aimerais toujours ça que dans les téléromans de Radio-Canada, au lieu d'avoir une avocate ou bien une artiste ou bien un docteur, ce qui n'est pas mauvais, pourquoi ils n'ont pas une cristallographe? Hein? Quelqu'un de très calé en mathématiques, comme héroïne, mais je crois que ça ôterait cette perception que ce n'est pas pour tout le monde, c'est pour tout le monde. Merci pour la question. Monsieur?
Thank you. In traditional Chinese philosophy, there's a famous thing called 天下为公. What are the world belong to our human beings? Yeah. So, you know, but we are living in a state and a national society. Yeah, we are living in the state, the national, international society. So, for you, how to cope with the cultural shocking? And how to keep the balance between the country imitation, honor, and individual endeavor, then?
It's an excellent question. The question is to, in this international world, and the fact that we work together, and particularly on the International Space Station, yeah. I guess that's what
besides,
you mean?
Besides the cooperation, we have the other ways to cope with the difficulties for human beings.
Yes. It's there are ways where it's difficult to cooperate, that's what you're saying. And but in the case of the International Space Station, I don't think you'll be surprised after my quasi-statistical demonstration today, is the fact that an astronaut today, it might be different in 100 years from now, but today is a type A type of person that likes doing things and solving things and is a bit of a go-go, likes to fly planes and go in circles and all this stuff. So they're very similar in type. So it turns out that an astronaut from Russia or from China or from Canada or from the United States, we are actually very, very similar. We are more similar than the cultural gap that separates us. That's why it's working so well up there. When do you hear a headline, no, brawl on board the space station? You haven't heard that, and there are people right there. Six people from five different nationalities. Why? Because the cultural gap is actually much lessened by the fact that everybody's focused and everybody is also very similar. I went to Beijing in 2008 to meet with some of the Chinese astronauts. And it was fascinating because they said they didn't speak English. I didn't quite believe that because I think they're very intelligent. I think they spoke much better English than I spoke Chinese. But it took like a few hours to realize that even though right now China has a separate program, it's not a partner of the International Space Station, and they were just the same. And they answered, we went all of us to school in Beijing and spoke to little kids. And my colleague, Li Wanwei, would answer the little kid's question exactly the way I would. Because, yeah, it didn't matter. And you know what? That is, again, I don't know about you, but me, it excites me about the future. About the future of us, not as a nation flag bearers all the time. It's a lot of fun. Love the Olympics. I'm actually a strong supporter of that. I like the competition. I like the fact that we're, you know, different nations and different communities and different nationalities and different everything. But at the same time, whenever we go outside that planet of ours, by the way, we share us all, then we become members of one race. Earthlings, human beings. And I really hope that the first day that somebody puts a foot on planet Mars, it won't be to plant a national flag, but to plant a symbol for all of humanity. Maybe I'm dreaming in technicolor, however. Yeah. Sir?
Well, she wants to become the first person to land on Mars.
We'll design you a flag. You know, I'm not the best one to answer that question. The question about, you know, when you are underestimated and lesser considered, how do you cope with that? Because it is the lot everywhere. That is the reason why women in general are paid less for any job. It's the reason why sometimes they are less considered. So, and in some countries, it's even worse. Here we are at the very top of the heap in terms of tolerance, equality of chances, and possibilities. Still, how do you cope with that? Well, parents are a huge part of it. Self-confidence, knowing that you can do it. And not settling also for those things that are different. But a lot of it also is on the leaders, and I consider myself part of. I've been so privileged to get where I've been. Now it's part of my job and my duty to make sure that some things change behind me. And that we all move forward, but a lot of it comes from self-confidence and almost stubbornness, hard-headedness. Avoir la tête dure, la tête de cochon. Il faut vraiment vouloir. Et ça, c'est en soi. If you want something, then be prepared to work, because it's nothing free, and that is across gender.
Thank you. Madam.
This has nothing to do with the subject, but you're an astronaut. The first time you went up and you looked down on Earth, what went through your mind?
The question is, well, first time I went up in space and I saw the Earth from above, what went through my mind? It's unfortunately a very unromantic answer, because I was a professional spacecraft operator. That's been my job for 18 years. So once you get up there, you have a job to do. And when you get up there for the first time, you're very worried about not doing that job well, because if you don't do it well, then you don't go back again. So that's going through your mind. And one of my first job, once we arrived in orbit and I unstrapped, was to open the cargo bay doors of the space shuttle, which gave me an absolute amazing view of the planet. But you are focused on the system, and it has all kinds of digitals changing, and you want to make sure that it follows its process, because you have your hand on the stop switch in case something goes wrong. You don't ask your colleague, "Ah, did you see that?" It's only a few days later that you start realizing how lucky you are to see our extraordinary, beautiful world from above. And that's exactly what it looks like. This is this is the space shuttle. We see the tail and the engine pods at the very bottom there. And this is what we see. We see the planet this way at 350 kilometers. And it's absolutely magnificent. I call it a blue marble in a sea of darkness. And it's our only home, the only place we've got for now. And therefore, we need to be careful about what we're doing down here. Thank you for the question, Madam.
As an educator who teaches children about science and space, what message would you send? Can I take to them? What message would? I just want kids to get lit. You want to go to Mars? I'm there.
I think we've answered a little bit that question about what to say to the young people. And to me, the answer is simple. Let's find out who you are. Let's introduce you to all kinds of things if we can. And be all you can be, but have goals, have interests, have objectives. And let us, adults and teachers and parents and aunts and uncles, foster that and help you and encourage you and be your cushion. Sometimes the help is just that. It's to be the cushion there. If it doesn't go exactly as planned, you can always come back. Well, I know that as a mom, my door will always be open, whatever they do. So I think that is important, but I'm not an expert in this. You know, I fly in spacecraft. So,
I have a related question. So, I like not your determination, but I think most of people somehow doubt of themselves. In my life, I doubt cope with that? I assume sometimes you doubt of yourself. How do you cope with that?
Completely oblivious for that. I'm very much of a Quebec girl. When you're a little kid, my parents love me, which is fundamental, and they encourage me, and the rest, the world was mine, right? I don't remember thinking a minute about any of this. This is because I'm now near 50 that I can reflect a little bit, and not that deeply, because I'm not a very deep person, but no, fly high, yeah? But I'd never thought about any of this before. I just went through life because I had the assurance behind and around that there was something I was good at. And there is. And it turns out that's what I exploited, and I was supported, and here we go, yeah? So there is something we're good at. Of course, if you choose something, let me go back to that first violinist. I wanted to go to music. I love music. So I actually sat right here, a couple of meters away, just before I went and sent in my application for McGill University, because I wasn't sure if I should apply to engineering or to the music faculty. And then I thought, and it was not that simple, because I was young and I wasn't that clear at the time, but now I've rationalized it a little better. I thought, well, I'm okay in music, but I'm not that great. So it will take a miracle for me to make a living out of this one. But I really love it. And then I love science and engineering, and I'm a doer. Engineering is my blood, so I'll do fine there. And I'll have a good living, and then I can do a lot of music. And it was exactly the right thing to do. Is that, of course, if you choose something that you're not the best at, well, then, of course, the bar is going to be a little higher. And you need a lot more confidence. So also, it's a lot easier to put effort in something you like and something you don't like. So if you choose something for somebody else, if you choose a profession for your parents, clearly it's not going to work, or there's a good chance it's not going to work. Madame.
I have two questions. One is, did engineering or music run in your family? Did your parents do it? And number two, how old were you when you first met your first astronaut?
Wow. My mom played the popular piano, but she is the one that probably put us into piano lessons at first, because I don't remember this far. My dad was an engineer, but he was the only one in his family that had ever been to college. To university, mechanical. Yeah, but he
did you choose some stuff when you were little?
Not that I remember. I played when I was a kid. and that too I encourage very much. I tell my son that he's got, because he's going to school, so clearly he's got responsibilities. His responsibility is go to school, do his homework, better himself, meaning like he doesn't have to be the first, the top of the class, but he needs to improve and have fun, because that part is really, 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 really important. So me, if you ask me about my childhood, I played. That's what I did. I went to school and I played. That's all I remember. Your second question about...
How old were you when you met your first astronaut in person?
Oh, man.
You're the first astronaut
I've met, so I'm wondering. In person, I think I must have been during my selection program when one of the person on the recruitment committee was Mark Garneau. And I was very impressed. But otherwise, and then afterwards... I met many of the Apollo astronauts, including Neil Armstrong, several times, because 528 people is not that many, so we tend to be to know each other, and or if not directly, but by name. So it's kind of interesting the first time you have coffee in the morning with John Young, who's flown on Gemini, on Apollo, went to the moon, one of the 12 persons that's walked on the moon, and then was the first flight of the space shuttle, and he's there with his Texan accent telling you what's going wrong with NASA, and it's perfect.
Did you already have your ATPL when you graduated, or was that?
No, I did all my pilot license during my astronaut training.
Really?
That was part of having to prove.
Okay.
But hey, what a great place to prove yourself is an airplane. Madam? I did say that there are a few more things I did not put in there because of, well, I think, you know, that one, but anyway, go ahead. Like one of my colleagues I did show, who the big major employer right now, besides Russia and China, is definitely getting there. But language is an issue, clearly. So is the United States. They recruit astronauts every 2 years, give or take, and they're building now a new heavy lifter with capsules. We have the emergence of commercial spaceflight, which is absolutely grand. I'll come back to McGill to give you my outlook on the future. It's pretty positive with commercial spaceflight. So people will be able to buy tickets within the next 10, 20 years to go suborbital for sure, and then even around. There will be infrastructure in the near-Earth orbit. So people from any nationality, any characteristic, and anywhere will be able to do that affordably. And if you want to be a professional, which, and that will expand again, then you'll have to apply to an astronaut program, and if you're not the right nationality, then you'll do like many of my colleagues did and naturalize. American is one of the way, or naturalize Canadian, but that one, the odds are a little less good. Madam.
What kind of response do you get from the, I'm American, asking about the Canadian response to your, when you make comments like that about the lack of or the absence of males on that particular, females on that particular board. So what kind of political response do you get when you make comments like that? I'm just curious.
I don't make comments like that. That's not my job. And
I just
stated a fact. Stating a fact, making a comment, is a very different thing. I'm in an audience here who can draw their own conclusion. I'm not going one way or the other. I think that let me answer that a little indirectly. The Quebec government, I don't know how many years ago, but some years ago, four or five years ago, has decreed that all the public societies, so all the société publique en anglais, c'est... But, no, it's the public entity. It's in a public entity. It's like a crown corporation, but on a provincial level. All crown corporation provincial level that was funded by the Quebec government would have to start striving for parity of men and women on their board of director. And they had up to 2014 and 2015 to obtain that. So I don't know exactly where the statistics are, but this made a huge change in that corporate idea and brought in a lot more interest and a lot more diversity on the board, and I think this is all for the better. So this is an example of a policy that helped out bringing in, it didn't say you got to hire this much or quota, but you've got to strive for, which is a different thing. And I think that this is maybe something that could be considered eventually at some other level. I think we are making enormous amount of progress, but in there, as I say, the United States are the leaders, and they're way far ahead. In that world, not everywhere.
Yeah.
Madam.
I just wanted to address something that you said in one of your responses, which was in science, for example, there's not a specific mold that you need to fit into. And I just want to respectfully disagree with that personal experience about 2 years ago. And I'm a graduate student, I'm a fourth year graduate student, and 2 years ago on a seminar based, so a small class with your peers, and we had to give these presentations. And we got feedback as a group, all together, from our peers and from the professor. And I remember that my biggest criticism, it wasn't the content, it wasn't what I'd done in the talk, it was that my personality was distracting from from the information that, and basically we're saying that personality was not as it should have been during the talk. And that hit me really hard. It was the first time that I've ever been sort of, had that been the only open critique of a talk. It wasn't what I had given, but it wasn't what I had communicated. It was just how I was. It was me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that we should pretend that these molds don't exist, because they do, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Just to be aware of them. And so, because a lot of people are like, I think you sort of addressed that in the talk. But it was a very strange experience. So there is a mold for a scientist, for example, in a biomedical research environment.
You see, we differ in what I'm saying and what you're experiencing. I fully agree that there are moles, but that's absolutely necessary and not true. And you've got to, I've had a similar experience when I was young too, when I was working for IBM, and they told me that I was way too exuberant. So I actually toned down because I could not make a good presentation. They taught me a lot, and I toned down because they were right. There are times when you are a nurse in an operating room. You're not going to go with your civilian clothes. And Miss, please forgive me if I use your example, but if you are going to put a helmet on to go into the space shuttle, you will have to remove your scarf. It's just, that is absolutely true. When I say you got to be yourself, I don't mean it in that kind of detail. I mean it in the sense that you can be those wider characteristics. And some of them you can't change. Where you were born, the color of your skin, unless you're someone special. And what language you spoke when you were a kid, right? What kind of family? We don't choose a family we're born in. We don't choose a country we're born in. But we all should be proud of some of the things. So you see what I mean is that, yes, you got to tone down sometimes in order to get to the goal. Remember the ambition, the goal, the objective? If you want that, you will have to get. So I didn't do anything I wanted at NASA. I tried to actually fit a ton. And I did find my grounds, but without losing myself completely. But let me tell you an anecdote, and I will have to end on this because I have a flight at 6 o'clock at Trudeau. thank Lord, I'm thinking Air Canada. So you remember that picture where I'm in the cockpit of this Tudor with all the panels and everything? I did my military training as a pilot in 1993. So I got sent to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, where they do the military training. And before I went out there, I thought, I'm not military, I'm not commissioned, I'm not in the armed forces, I'm an astronaut, I'm a girl, yeah, how are they going to receive me there? I really wanted to fit in because it was one of my dreams to fly jets. So I thought, well, I'll cut my hair. Then, you know, I'll fit in better, I'll be able to put the helmet in better. So here I go, I went to the to the hairdresser, and I had my hair cut. I woke up in the middle of the night screaming because my hair was gone. I never had short hair, really. But I'm like, you know, this is for the cause. This is good. So I go out there, and maybe a couple weeks into it, I'm taxiing the airplane to park it, and there's a guy, tech guy, who's telling me when to stop and everything. So open the cockpit, take my helmet off. And this technician, who was a master sergeant, would have never said that to anybody in the military, but I'm not quite military, I'm kind of hybrid. So he looked at me and he says, oh, having a bad hair day, ma'am? That's when I realized that detail was not important. Cutting my hair was not the point. I could have had long hair, and I've had long hair since. That was a detail that was not the one to adjust. It was other details I needed to adjust to fit in. And that, unfortunately, I can't tell you what they are, but they're tough. Right? They're out there. But this is an excellent, this is the first time I get that question. Thank you so much. I hope it helped. Thank you very much for being here.